Hi there, welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer, always great having your company. Today on the program, Stephen Fitzgerald. Now, he was our first ambassador to the People's Republic. He'll respond to Julie Bishop's controversial speech on China. Should China conform to Western expectations and embrace democracy? What about Chinese nationalism, which is rising? Is that compatible with a smooth transition to democracy? And what about China's history? Any experience of multi-party democracy, loyal oppositions, peaceful transfers of power, separation of the executive, judiciary, and a free press? Plus, as the government proposes to reform those hate laws, we'll hear the affirmative case for Section 18C today. Stay with us for that. Well, Julie Bishop raised eyebrows recently in Singapore. Now, if you missed the story, here it is. Addressing the International Institute of Strategic Studies, the foreign minister, she didn't just call on the United States to enhance its security presence in Asia in the face of a rising China. That was one thing. She also warned China would never reach its full potential unless it embraces democracy. Now, not surprisingly, these remarks did upset Beijing's sensibilities, but it's important to note Bishop here was also at odds with the foreign policy consensus in Canberra. Now, you think about it. Ever since Gough Whitlam's opening in the early 1970s, our prime ministers and foreign ministers, they've generally refrained from lecturing the communist leaders about the merits of democracy or calling for any kind of containment of China. One prominent China watcher who's played an indispensable role in forging closer Sino-American relations during the past half century, he's my next guest. Stephen Fitzgerald was Australia's first ambassador to the People's Republic of China. He's author of Comrade Ambassador, published by MUP. Stephen, welcome back to Between the Lines.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
What did you make of Julie Bishop's comments?
Extraordinary, for several reasons. I mean, one, it does appear that this was not drafted in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So it came out of her office. Two, as you've mentioned, it's at odds with the general line that Australian governments have taken over decades. And one of the important things about dealing with foreign governments of any kind, but particularly these great powers like China, is to be consistent. If you have suddenly, out of the blue, some totally inconsistent message emerging, that means that China will be wondering, what is this about? Does this mean that there's a shift in policy? What's going on? So that's part of it. Another part is what she said about democracy. And it was not just about China, by the way. She was talking about across the region, that everyone had become democracies. Well, she made the speech in Singapore. Now, Singapore has a democracy of a kind, but it's not like democracy we have here. And across Southeast Asia, if you look at the countries that she was talking about, it amounts to lecturing them as well. And then we come to China. And it seems to me that there's a failure here on her part to accept the reality that is China. Now, this doesn't mean you can't have a view, but we have to deal with China as it is today, however much we might wish that it were democratic like us or a more perfect version of us. That's not the case today. So your attention and your imagination have to focus on the here and the now.
And there's a question of the history. Is there anything in Chinese history that would indicate a smooth transition to democracy in China?
No, not in the history of that part of China, which is currently under control of the People's Republic. Now, as we know, in Taiwan, there's been a transition to a democracy.
And South Korea too.
And South Korea.
I mean, the tremendous advances in economic freedom and political freedom. So Bishop's supporters will come back to you and say, there are historical precedents here of democracies flourishing in East Asia.
There are, although they rode to their prosperity on the basis of authoritarian governments, and it was only after they achieved that prosperity that they became democratic. I'd argue that the situation on the Chinese mainland is very different. The population is approaching something like 1.4 billion people. There is, amongst most Chinese, I'd suggest, a visceral fear of chaos. Luan is the Chinese word. And to go back to the time of Tiananmen, I asked many people outside of China, including in Taiwan, what they thought of the Chinese government cracking down on the protesters. Mm-hmm. And almost universally, the response was, you can't have chaos. You can't have that kind of chaos. Now, whether we agree with that or not, that is a Chinese view.
So your point then is that from China's perspective, fear of things getting out of hand, a return to the chaos of the relatively recent past, they're very real.
They're very real. Now, it doesn't mean, of course, that the leadership doesn't have other motives, like the president, Xi Jinping, increasing his control over the whole of the mechanism and the institutions of government and the military and the party. I mean, he has his motivations about power and gathering power into his own hands and staying there in power. But part of the reason why it's able to continue is that amongst the populace, there is this feeling.
Mm. Some experts, such as the distinguished University of Sydney historian Neville Maney, argue that Chinese leaders, far from embracing democracy, are far more likely to strengthen their claim to be nationalists by emphasising a century of humiliation. Plausible?
Plausible, but it's not the only thing that's going on. But it has a strong appeal. And interestingly, this started in the wake of the June 4th Tiananmen incident in 1989, and the whole thrust of the content of education started to change and to emphasise the 100 years of humiliation, the nationalist symbols, to reintroduce Confucianism.
These are the history textbooks.
Yeah, not only history, but in the day-to-day teaching in high schools. We have an expert here at UTS who has done research on this, who's taken the textbooks and analysed them, particularly over that period in the 10 years after Tiananmen. And so you see all of these ideas and these symbols coming in.
So your point then is that in the last 20 or so years, the Chinese leaders are already making gestures towards this new nationalist sensibility. Less focus on Marx and more on Confucius.
Yes, Confucius is certainly resurrected and on a pedestal. And while they may mouth some of the slogans of Marxism, that's not the real issue.
And to the extent that China continues to be more nationalist, is that incompatible with democracy as well?
I don't think so. I think we can have extreme nationalism in democracies. Mm. We're seeing it in democracies around the world at the moment. And down the line, it may become incompatible, and I hope that's not going to happen, but we have seen that happen in history.
My guest is Stephen Fitzgerald, our first ambassador to the People's Republic of China, and he's author of Comrade Ambassador. Stephen, the South China Sea, China has bulked up, it built many disputed islands in that region. It's also ignored the Hague's ruling last year. To what extent does a more assertive China represent a threat to the region?
Well, I don't think it does. And I think we see this in the attitudes of Southeast Asian countries and in recent developments on the part of three of the main Southeast Asian claimants to that disputed sea, where they have gone to China and come away not only with fistfuls of commercial deals, but with understandings that will help to ameliorate the tensions in the South China Sea. So the way we see it and the way Washington sees it is somewhat different from the way Southeast Asians see it.
Do you think there's a danger that we're pushing China into a corner? I mean, from Beijing's perspective, and this is a point that people like Henry Kissinger, Malcolm Fraser, before he died, made, that the enhanced US strategic engagement in the region, from Beijing's perspective, is seen as encirclement. And rising Japanese nationalism, which is tolerated by Washington in their view, is responsible for the crisis in the East China Sea. How would you respond to that general view?
Yeah, I think there's a big danger of misperception. Mm. We in Australia have long had a problem with understanding the perceptions of the Chinese government. We have had an inability to go round the other side of the curtain and try to look at the world the way the Chinese see it and to understand why they use that language, which is not the language that we would use. So unless we can get closer to the Chinese, much, much closer, to an extent that our leaders actually understand the Chinese and the way they think and the way they express their views on foreign policy, there remains always the risk of problems with China.
Do you think we're too close to the Americans, Stephen?
Yes, I think we're far too close. I don't think we should be embedded in the way we are in the US military. This carries with it a risk of us getting involved in conflict. We don't know what is going to be the ultimate direction of Donald Trump's foreign policy. But if it is as unpredictable and willful as we've seen a lot of his domestic initiatives, then there is an increased risk of miscalculation, military miscalculation. And we are there, deeply embedded in the armed forces, and we shouldn't be.
To be sure, though, Stephen, Tony Abbott was very close to the Americans, but even he, much to the angst of the Obama administration, did support Australia's inclusion in the China-led Asian Infrastructure Bank. And Malcolm Turnbull, notwithstanding intense lobbying from the Pentagon, has refused Australian participation in those freedom of navigation patrols. Doesn't that show that we can be close allies with the United States, but at the same time exercise discrimination and even independence within the alliance?
It does to some extent, but I still believe that the closeness has too great an influence on the way we perceive China as an alleged threat to us. It's not a threat to Australia. Our interests in this are not the interests of the United States. The only situation in which China is likely to threaten us for the foreseeable future is through some conflict with the United States in which we become inadvertently engaged. So those examples that you quote, yeah, sure. And I wish there were more of them, and there should be more of them. But this doesn't solve the problem of the deep engagement, not only between the defense forces and the intelligence services, but also what I call the addiction that our leaders seem to have to the kind of analysis that Washington has.
Finally, Stephen, Hugh White, the distinguished scholar at ANU, former defense policy planner, writing in the New York Times just recently, he said that Australia will move further away from the Americans and closer to China as Chinese power increases and American power diminishes, especially in the Trump era. It sounds like you would agree with Hugh White.
Yes. Whether that's inevitable or not, I think remains a question. I think it's desirable. I think the big challenge for Australia now is to accept the reality of China and to set out to get so close to China that we can actually have influence on it. If we can't have influence on it, then we're going to be in trouble. So that is why we have to move away. Perhaps Hugh is right. Perhaps it is inevitable. I don't see the inevitability of it yet.
But that's not denying some very serious internal challenges that China faces. I mean, environmental, demography, economic. I mean, their growth rates have come down substantially in the last 10 years, right?
Yep, they're huge. But the important thing is that some of these issues the Chinese are trying to tackle, the environment, for example, they are alarmed by what's happening to the environment in China. So they have embarked on quite serious initiatives to try to do something about environment and climate. They understand the issues of the economy. They've moved over the last decade from having export-led growth into growth that's led by domestic consumption. And this transition has been managed quite well without collapse, as some people predicted would happen. And by and large, the system retains a strong element of stability. I don't see in the immediate or medium-term future a collapse of the Chinese system.
Stephen, great to see you again. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Okay, thank you.
That was Stephen Fitzgerald, our first ambassador to the People's Republic of China.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
The government is proposing changes to Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. This law makes it unlawful to cause people to feel offended, insulted, humiliated or intimidated because of their race, colour or national or ethnic origin. Now, you may recall Chris Mitchell. He's a former editor of The Australian. He was on this program recently making the case for reform.
Look, I think the point really is about speech. You know, that the idea that you can't be rented a house because of your ethnicity is quite different from the idea that I can't discuss your ethnicity in a piece in the newspaper or in a cartoon. And I think that's where this whole thing has gotten out of hand. It seems to me that when it all came up in the 1980s and it was originally a law sponsored by Bob Hawke, nobody would have envisaged that this law would be used by activists to shut down debate about things like Aboriginal welfare.
That was Chris Mitchell on Between the Lines a fortnight ago. Well, today let's hear from a leading academic who defends Section 18C as it is. Catherine Gelber is Professor at the School of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Queensland in Brisbane. Hi there, Kath. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Now, the government wants to delete the words offend, insult and humiliate and replace them with harass. What's so wrong with that proposal?
Well, firstly, there's absolutely no mandate to do it. This is a campaign that's been running very heavily in the newspapers, but there's not a lot of public support for it. So, for example, this week's Fairfax poll showed that 78% of people, when asked the question, do you think Section 18C should be changed, say no. That's a very, very high level of support in the general community for the racial vilification laws that we have at the moment. And the other big problem with the proposal to insert the word harass is that it sets a very, very different standard from the current wording of Section 18C, a very restrictive standard, which is likely to mean that it's going to be much, much harder in future, if this proposal is successful, to lodge a successful claim of racial vilification under Section 18C.
Yet your critics would say that the current benchmark is so low that the Australian Human Rights Commission has dragged out several prominent cases needlessly. For example, the complaints against the cartoonist Bill Leak and those QUT students. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that grossly misrepresents the facts. The evidence is that the vast majority of complaints are dealt with very quickly, especially by the Australian Human Rights Commission, which has a very good record on this, and that they afford a very modest remedy to the person bringing the complaint. It is true that there have been one or two what you might call bad cases, in the sense that they've achieved a lot of media coverage for the slowness with which the Australian Human Rights Commission dealt with them. But one or two bad cases don't make a bad law. There are all kinds of laws in existence in relation to which there are one or two bad cases that have hit the media. And it's very, very unusual to respond to those cases by saying this is proof that the law is wrong and needs to be thrown out.
And yet you've got someone like Irene Moss, who was the former Race Discrimination Commissioner. Her 1991 report on racial violence led to the introduction of Section 18C. She believes the law should be changed. And she says, quote, the Section 18C ignored the inquiry's warnings that an offence which was drafted too broadly could lead to trivial complaints and confusion.
Well, to that I'd respond that it hasn't. So again, look at the evidence. Luke McNamara and I did a large study into the effects of racial anti-vilification laws in Australia over 25 years. It was very clear from that study that there's a very small number of trivial complaints and there's not very much confusion. In fact, primarily what there is, or there was before this big public debate, is ignorance in the target communities of the existence of racial vilification laws. I'd also like to respond to the point that Chris Mitchell made in your introduction. Mm-hmm. He said that Section 18C means you can't discuss ethnicity in the newspaper anymore. It shuts down debate. Nothing could be further from the truth. Section 18C provides a modest remedy under an anti-discrimination law where, in the best of all possible worlds, a complaint is lodged and there's a mediated resolution where the person who made the comments says, actually, I didn't realise that those comments crossed a line. Now I do realise and I'm going to agree to stop doing it in future. It's absolutely not true that people cannot discuss important matters of public policy that intersect with questions of ethnicity and race.
Well, on Chris Mitchell and The Australian, do you think they should have published that controversial Bill Leak cartoon on the Indigenous issue?
Look, my preference would have been not to, but only because I do not think that cartoon was in any way constructive in terms of the public debate. It was a bit of a cheap shot. But it is also my view that that cartoon was protected by Section 18D, which is the clause in the legislation that allows for exemptions, for good faith reporting of matters in public debate, and for scientific and educational and artistic endeavours. So I think it's highly likely, had that complaint proceeded, that it would have been found to have been exempt under Section 18D, and people forget about Section 18D when they talk about Section 18C.
Yeah, the point the Oz is making, though, Kath, is that Bill Leak was subjected to a lot of humiliation himself. You know, he felt that he was really under a lot of duress during this process when the Human Rights Commission reviewed the case. And meanwhile, you did have several leading Aboriginal figures like Noel Pearson, Warren Mundine, Anthony Dillon, they came to Bleak's defence saying that, you know, the cartoon was controversial, but it reflected an accurate portrayal of the problems of family dysfunction in remote Indigenous communities. That's what they were saying. So the fact that Leak was under so much pressure over that one cartoon, does that suggest that maybe the law was going too hard here, even though he was never actually punished?
Well, in the end, the person who brought the complaint stated publicly that what she'd wanted to do was have a sit down with Bill Leak and talk to him about the effects of that cartoon. And because it became very clear at an early stage that there was going to be no prospect of that, she withdrew the complaint. So in the end, it did not proceed because the complainant withdrew. Look, there was some pressure on Bill Leak over that. But again, one situation of pressure against a cartoonist does not make a bad law. And the duress and pressure felt by targets of vilification is daily. Mm. And it's cumulative. And they talked to us again in this project I did with Luke McNamara. We interviewed 101 members of target communities all around Australia in rural and regional areas in every state. And they told us not only that racial vilification is unrelenting and that it happens to their children, it happens in workplaces, on public transport, at social events, at sporting events, at community events, everywhere. But they also told us how cumulatively the effects of these really impacted on their ability to express their religious freedom, to express their own free speech, to associate with others. It had really significant impacts on their lives. And this law is a modest law that tries to do something to address those cumulative harms.
My guest is Catherine Gelber, Professor at the School of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Queensland, and we're talking about changes to Section 18C. Kath, how do racial and ethnic minorities, how would they feel threatened by the government's proposed changes to remove the words offend, insult and humiliate?
Well, they do feel threatened by it. They think that this is the government saying to the community very clearly, we're giving you a green light to engage in more racial vilification than you have until this point in time. So it's very clear that a number, not uniformly, not absolutely everybody in the community, but a number of racial and ethnic minorities feel that these changes are the wrong message to send. And I'd like to make a point there about the difference between the change from a legal point of view and the change from a symbolic point of view. So legally, if you were to go not quite as far as the government has proposed and perhaps remove the words offend and insult from the legislation, but leave in humiliate and intimidate. Legally speaking, that wouldn't make much difference to the operation of the law, because we've had court cases in a very clear line of cases since 2001 say that for conduct to be unlawful under Section 18C, it has to amount to a significant public harm. So it's very clear that you can't lodge a complaint if your feelings have just been hurt.
All that being said, though, some might say, you know, just with free speech comes great responsibility not to gratuitously offend. But that responsibility belongs to the individual, not the state, and the consequences for breaching it should be social, not governmental. What's wrong with that argument?
Look, I agree with that argument in principle. I just don't see much evidence that people, particularly people with authority and power, are exercising that responsibility to speak well. And I think that rightly, racial and ethnic minorities in Australia sense that and feel that and experience that every day. So the argument itself makes complete sense. But the fact is that our government made a decision in 1995 that it was going to draw a line in the sand about if speech amounts to a significant public harm, we're going to say that it's not okay. And what we're going to do is encourage people to engage in those debates in ways that don't harm people.
You know, the Americans don't have anything like Section 18C, but there was a case a few years ago, and I'm going from my memory, where the head of the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team, he left a very rude voicemail message on his girlfriend's machine where he was saying racist things about African Americans. She leaked it to the press. This guy's career was destroyed. He lost his job. He had to pay a lot of compensation and whatnot. That was society working. You didn't have a law here punishing this guy. Some will say society, because we've generally speaking become more progressive over the years, won't tolerate that kind of behaviour.
Well, I guess I'd like to push back on the idea that we're becoming more progressive. I think global politics right now is showing that it's quite possible for societies to go in either direction, depending on the leadership and the political mores of the day. So I wouldn't rest on our laurels, so to speak, that things are going to necessarily get better. We also have those social consequences. So, for example, there have been some incidents on public transport in Australia in which members of the public have videoed racist abuse by people on public transport and then uploaded that online. And that has led to a very severe backlash against those people. And interestingly,
backlash against the people saying nasty things.
Yes.
Well, that's a good thing though, isn't it? Doesn't that show that society's working well? We don't need laws though to do it.
Well, it does show that society can work well in the sense of calling those people to account on occasion, but we also know that that doesn't happen in every instance, nor does using that kind of method give a symbolic message to the target communities that the government has drawn a line in the sand. The government doesn't want you to be harmed by public debate.
Okay, well, let's turn to one of the big controversial cartoon cases internationally, and that, of course, is the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist who were murdered by Islamist terrorists 2 years ago. Now, in response, people around the world proclaimed, "We are Charlie," but under our law, those cartoonists, they may have breached Section 18C. Is there a double standard here?
Look, I think that what people were saying when they were saying "We are Charlie" was expressing solidarity with the idea that the pen is mightier than the sword and that we should today in global politics resolve our differences through words and deliberation and not through guns. And that is an extremely powerful message and one with which I wholeheartedly agree. So I think that's the message that people were trying to send when they said "Je suis Charlie." I think it would be wrong to interpret that global movement as somehow being a movement against the idea of racial hatred laws. I think, by contrast, it was a message of solidarity about using peaceful means to resolve disputes.
Okay, Kath, final question. Many critics of Section 18C, they will continue to fret and wail that there are many serious subjects that now can't be debated openly without inspiring immediate hysteria. By keeping Section 18C as it is, how do you ease their concerns?
I would encourage people to look at the evidence. Fewer than 1.8% of complaints lodged nationally under all our racial vilification laws or all our anti-vilification laws end up in courts or tribunals for adjudication. Those that end up in courts and tribunals are a minute proportion of the overall complaint system. We need to listen to targets. The majority of complaints get a very modest remedy. It was very clear from that research I did that there is no evidence of a chilling effect in Australian politics. The Prime Minister, when he announced these proposed changes to Section 18C, said Section 18C in its current form has a chilling effect on free speech. There is absolutely no evidence to support that claim. Our studies show that there's plenty of evidence of rigorous public debate on matters of public interest that intersect with race and ethnicity and nationality. There is no evidence of the chilling effect. So I just strongly encourage people, look at the numbers of complaints that end up in court or tribunal. Don't look at the exceptional cases. Look at the vast majority of cases in anti-discrimination authorities around the country that are settled modestly and happily with very little intervention from lawyers. Look at the fact that there isn't a chilling effect from these laws.
Kath, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Tom.
That was Catherine Gelber from the University of Queensland in Brisbane. So that's all for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Remember, if you'd like to download this episode or back issues, or even send us a comment, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompted Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Great having your company. Hope you can tune in again next week.